From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Speaker Madigan, turn in your homework. You passed a bill to fund our schools, but you're hiding it. You're sitting on it.
Regarding school funding reform, the governor has adopted a no-compromise position, which will keep the state in chaos for several weeks and months. We need reasonable people, again, Democrats and Republicans, as we did on the budget, to resolve the differences which are leading toward an impasse.
Unfortunately, he has put members of the Republican caucus in the House and the Senate in very precarious situations where they really want to work with us. They're even scared to say anything because they have no idea what the governor wants.
We're all here. The General Assembly's here. Speaker Madigan and President Culleton chose to do nothing while we're all here.
That's Governor Bruce Rauner. We also heard from the Representative Will Davis, a Democrat in there, and also the Democratic Speaker of the Illinois House, Michael Madigan. Lawmakers have nothing to show for the past few days of special session, yet schools are left wondering what the future may hold when it comes to funding. We're going to talk about that and more on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford, and our panel, all in studio with me today, includes the IPR Education Desk reporter Dusty Rhodes, Kent Redfield, Professor Emeritus with the University of Illinois Springfield, and Hannah Meisel, who's the Springfield reporter for Law 360. And Hannah, good to have you back on with us.
I'm glad to be here.
And Kent, glad to have you with us as well.
Good to be here.
Dusty, I'm going to start with you, though, because you've been really following this quite a bit. That what has happened over the last several weeks is we got a state budget. But the education portion, the money that goes to schools from that budget, is tied up. I've heard it referred to as a poison pill was inserted to say if the state does not put a new funding formula in place for how it distributes money to schools, the money remains tied up. Can you talk about what is on the table right now, what the fight's all about?
Okay, so the other term I've heard for that mechanism is a booby trap. I remember Representative Will Davis being very clear when that measure passed that he said it on the floor that this means that you can't fund schools until we enact an evidence-based model. I think it was a little noisy on the floor, and I don't think everyone heard, but he made it very clear. So what that means, everybody agrees that we need the evidence-based model. Republicans agree, Democrats agree, the governor agrees. What they don't agree on is, you know, we keep saying that the governor likes 90% of that bill, Senate Bill 1. Senator Jason Berrickman, a Republican, has an almost duplicate bill, Senate Bill 1124. The difference between them is how generous they are to Chicago public schools.
You mentioned Senate Bill 1. That's the only one that has gotten through both chambers. It's not on the governor's desk yet. That's something he's made very clear. He wants to get it there because he wants to change it. And it's all about the Chicago schools, at least from what he's been saying.
Right. And, you know, when they say the governor likes 90% of it, Senator Berrickman says, yes, but that 10% is 100% of the problem. So, it's how they treat Chicago public schools. It's mainly the part that the governor wants to talk about is Chicago teacher pensions. Chicago is the only district that pays their own teacher pensions. The rest of us pay for all the rest of the districts. The other part that the governor nor Senator Berrickman want to talk about is the Chicago public school block grant. The numbers that the governor has put out suggests that he would eliminate most of that block grant. But, you know, even yesterday after Berrickman's press conference, I caught him in the hallway and asked him about the block grant. He wouldn't say a word about it. It's like it's Voldemort.
Well, school funding is probably one of the more complicated issues that they deal with at the Capitol, maybe that and pensions. But certainly Chicago schools, I mean, the amount of students who go to Chicago schools makes up a huge chunk of what is educated in the state of Illinois. So it's a big thing to have Chicago schools get the money they need. Why is this particular thing such a big deal? I mean, like Dusty said, it sort of puts them on par with the rest of the state. Hannah, can you kind of talk about why this is such a big change?
Sure. For years,
Democrats have said that other school districts in the state have gotten what they called a free lunch by getting their pension for their teachers paid for by the state, whereas Chicago public Chicago taxpayers essentially have to pay twice because they pay into the regular TIRS pension system for the rest of the state, but then they also have to pay into Chicago Public Schools teacher pensions. This is also such a big deal right now because Chicago Public Schools have are facing kind of a historic budget crunch right now. Last year, they had several points that CPS CEO Forrest Claypool threatened that, you know, they might have to shut down early, or, you know, in January, he said, you know, we might have to end school 3 weeks early. And they're facing a tremendous budget shortfall. They are kind of frozen on some things that they can and cannot do. For example, in 2013, they shut down 52 schools, but they're, you know, now they can't shut down any other schools at the moment to save money. And, you know, Chicago Public Schools is a huge, huge deal. And they're losing a lot of students. And that's going to be an economic drag on the city of Chicago. If people don't want to send their kids to CPS, they might just forego living in Chicago altogether, which further brings down the city and its coffers.
And of course, Kent, there's a lot of history when it comes to Chicago schools, how they're funded, this pension issue. This goes back a while, including certainly back into the 90s, maybe even before that.
Yeah, I mean, historically, this has been an issue in terms of how you treat Chicago versus the rest of the state. But specifically, when you get to Chicago schools, then there was an agreement in 1995 when the Republicans had both chambers of the legislature and Governor Edgar, you know, Republican, was the governor. Then there was a Chicago school reform package. It gave control of the Chicago schools to the mayor of Chicago, and rather than being a separate governmental entity. That was quite, you know, innovative. It was a big deal at that time. A number of cities have emulated it, some with more success than others. But the pension part of that, Chicago had been paying their own pensions. They had a dedicated property tax that was going to paying those pensions. That property tax went away. There was flexibility given to the city in terms of how they were dealing with the whole budget for the Chicago schools. There was also an agreement that the state would provide some resources, some money, because of the fact that Chicago was being treated differently. And so you've got both the state not keeping up with what was kind of the understanding of the extra support Chicago would get, and then terrible mismanagement within the Chicago schools in terms of, you know, skipping pension payments because they didn't have to make them. I mean, now, truth be told, the Chicago Public Schools pension system, the percentage of unfunded liability is actually lower. I mean, it's terrible in all cases, but it's lower. You know, they're in better shape than the teachers' retirement system. So, you know, this is a problem. This formula, I mean, Senate Bill 1 tries to get at, let's smooth all of this out. I think there are provisions after this first year to even do some more smoothing in terms of things. And so, you know, but right now it's a leverage point. It comes after the governor losing on the budget and the property tax increase. It's a chance to score political points and play regional politics. And so, you know, there's a huge policy problem that we have to work through, but it gets played out in terms of the political fight. And so nobody wants to be blamed for the schools not opening. Everybody assumes that's going to happen, but we're trying to get the maximum political advantage. The danger here, of course, is if you get down to the 23rd hour and the 59th minute, and you don't have the votes to override or accept a mandatory veto, the bill dies. I mean, so it's a very dangerous game of chicken, and the governor really doesn't want, you know. He thinks, you know, some people in his staff may believe that if schools don't open, well, we'll blame the legislature. But it becomes a competency issue for the governor in terms of, can you do your job? So, you know, he's playing a very high-risk game here, as is the legislature. I mean, we're, you know, and again, the public's reaction to this, they don't understand the mechanics. All they know is they're screwing around in Springfield and my kids may not be able to go to school. And that, you know, that's not a good outcome for anybody.
Well, Dusty, let me go back to when this was all being debated, and maybe not even this particular bill, but certainly this issue over the last many months and really many years. It's always seemed to focus on these poor downstate schools, or maybe somebody in the East St. Louis school district, or maybe it's just some rural school district that just doesn't have the money and resources to do what it needs. And suddenly Chicago's back in the middle of this. How did this all happen? Was this a last-minute thing, or was this talked about during that process and I just missed it?
Well, I remember last session, the previous proposal by Senator Andy Menar, who this one is his fourth. So he's really done more legislating on this issue than any.
He's led the way, really.
So. Yeah. But I remember a lot of floor speeches railing about the Chicago bailout. So it's not it is not really new. I think that is just a phrase that gets everybody heated up.
And I guess as we move along with this, and I mean, we're waiting to see, the last thing I had heard was that Senate President John Cullerton says he'll release the bill to the governor, I believe on Monday. He's held onto it up to this point. They passed this back in May. Why is it taking so long to get this to the governor so at least something can go forward?
So what Senate President John Cullerton maintains is that he doesn't want to release the bill to the governor for the governor to automatically just mandatorily veto it. The Senate president maintains that he wants negotiation to happen before he releases the bill. The governor on the other side says, no, that's not how the process is supposed to work. So the governor, a couple weeks ago now, he vowed to AV the bill. Reporters have not gotten any exact approximation of how he would exactly AV the bill. We know, you know, obviously he doesn't like this, what, $230 million in Chicago Public School pension help. But other than that, he's hinted at redistributing the money to other school districts, but, you know, he hasn't exactly said how. And then there's been a lot of constitutional confusion on this issue this week. Which has not added to, it has not been helpful for anyone on either side.
Well, he's more than hinted at redistributing it. He's got this spreadsheet. He's got a website with a spreadsheet that has three columns. One is what Senate Bill 1, what your district will get under Senate Bill 1. The other one is what your district will get under, quote unquote, our plan, which is not in writing. But anyway, there's a series of numbers. And then the third column is the difference. So how much more you get under the governor's plan. And everybody gets a bunch more except for Chicago, which under his plan would lose $145 million. So, but, you know, we've been asking and asking for the basis of those numbers and haven't gotten them. I finally did a FOIA to the State Board of Education to try to see if he had, you know, sent an email that said, here's what I want modeled. And instead, you know, they had just done a kind of diagram of instructions for everybody to make their own model. One thing that has always been part of the conversation is that there should be no red numbers. No district should lose. So there's a base funding minimum. That's what they're calling the hold harmless provision. And, you know, the Democrats argue that taking away that block grant from Chicago Public Schools, that would make them the only district that loses money. And that may be why they don't want to talk about it.
And there's also a, you know, in terms of the process, once the governor gets the bill and vetoes it, it comes back to the legislature. That sets a 15-day calendar going. And so if you get it on, you know, Monday, you get it vetoed immediately or on Tuesday, then you're starting, you run those 15 days out, you're now, you know, August 13th, 14th, you know, according to Rich Miller's Capital Facts column this morning, you know, his newsletter this morning, you know, the Senate Democrats have attendance problems in terms of getting their people back in town. And so, you know, if that's one of the parameters, then, you know, if they want to take a shot at overriding or even accepting the veto, you know, that you're getting right up against the deadline for it getting out of the Senate. You're also getting up against, you know, when are the payments supposed to be done? When can the districts make their decisions and stuff? And so, the legislative process is playing a role in terms of the strategy here. But the more that you push this into, you know, the second week of August, the more that you're setting up a situation where, you know, everything has to go, or you're going to, you know, you could have a disaster. And so the governor's statement today, with some willingness to have the legislative leaders sit down and talk after he gets the bill towards having something happen by, you know, he's always said, you know, the July
31st.
But, you know, if you get it done next week, an agreement that everybody can sign off on, then, you know, everybody's safe. The closer you get to when are the payments due, when is the deadline for getting the bill out of the Senate, you know, if you don't override and you don't accept, the bill dies.
Well, the governor just released a statement this morning asking for negotiation. It was, you know, I don't want to read too much into tone, but it seemed like a very different tone. You know, he said the statement said that he had asked legislative leaders to get together and negotiate. I've confirmed with one source that they've been reaching out. So who knows? It may be changing while we're sitting in here.
Hannah, I don't want you to have to crawl inside the governor's head on this and figure out what he's actually saying. But at the same time, is this more a political stance that he's taking at this point, that he sees gain out of fighting against Chicago, which he probably – that area, he's not likely to win anyway in a reelection bid. Does he think that fighting against the Chicago school district, that will help him in this respect? Or does he really have some serious issues with how this was all put together?
I mean, I do think it's both. From the beginning, you know, from the moment he started running, basically, he has said the Chicago machine has damaged the state for too long. And CPS, for better or worse, has been a pawn in that Chicago machine. But also, I think that he sees the legislative process as it's played out for SB1 kind of going over his head, and he's trying to grab something that will, you know, wrest a little bit of power back to him.
I'm not sure if this is, you know, a conscious factor, but Chicago public schools have teacher, you know, obviously they have a teacher union, very, very powerful teacher union. And he famously likes charter schools. He's got his name on one, a Noble charter school, Rauner Prep. And they, you know, famously don't have teacher unions, although the Noble Network teachers have been trying to get a union lately. I'm not even sure where that stands. But, you know, that kind of aligns with his overall agenda against unions.
So maybe if this was money going straight to the classroom for something else, you think he might be okay with it, but because it's somehow tied to teachers and their retirement benefits, that maybe he's not so much.
Unionized teachers, right. And whatever damage, you know, might come to Chicago public schools because of taking away some of their funding might not bother him much because that might drive more people into charter schools.
There seems as though, and you've covered this quite a bit, there seems as though there has been Republicans and Democrats, upstate, downstate, who have worked together on some of these issues. They have differences of opinion, of course, but they have worked somewhat together. Do you think they can come to some compromise here? And as Kent was alluding to earlier, avoid that disaster of maybe some schools not opening on time or you know, worried about being able to keep their doors open for very long. Does it seem as though the sort of cooler heads would prevail?
I hope so. I mean, you know, the moment in one of the committees, I forget which committee hearing it was where Senate Bill 1 got some bipartisan, or maybe it was House Bill 2808, the House version of Senate Bill 1, where it got bipartisan votes, it felt like there was going to be a balloon drop. I mean, it was that euphoric in the room. Like, people are finally agreeing on a school funding reform measure because, you know, this has been so long in the making. I don't think we've mentioned that Illinois has the most inequitable school funding formula in the nation, and everybody wants to change it.
And Hannah, before I switch to a different topic here, your thoughts on the same thing. I mean, are you hearing in the halls of the Capitol that, you know, something can be worked out on this, that this is not going to be something that lingers, like the budget, for example, the budget impasse lingered, that they can get this done relatively quickly?
I think even more than the budget, this has to get done. You know, we say, like, oh, some schools might not open. Our new colleagues at the Daily Line Springfield did some actual, you know, data gathering. They called some school districts, and they found that it's 20 of the 800-some school districts in Illinois would definitely not be able to open on time in the next, like, 3-4 weeks whenever schools open. And while that's not, you know, all of the schools, it's not even half, it's not even a quarter, it's still not an insignificant amount. That still represents thousands of children, thousands of families. And so the budget, unfortunately, it's been proven that the state can run on no budget for 2 years. But schools not opening, that, you know, that goes back to the summer of 2015 when, you know, we'd sit around in, you know, State Week or on other, you know, lots of think pieces would be written about how, well, if schools don't open, that'll be the crisis point. Well, this, we finally reached that hypothetical crisis point. And I think lawmakers more than anything want to get this done. And it's not as complicated as a budget. It doesn't have as many moving parts, I would say.
And I would think that if schools don't open, if most parents aren't going to care about whether it was the Republicans' fault or the Democrats' fault. Right. They're going to blame them all. But right. I did want to save a few minutes here at the end to talk a little bit about something. I almost hate to bring this up. There is an election coming up next year that we're going to have to watch. And certainly it's expected to be the maybe the most expensive governor's race in the country, certainly probably in the state's history. We know that. We're already seeing some numbers show up. And according to Kent, what are you seeing right now with some of these fundraising numbers?
Well, after, you know, reports came in that would show the first six, you know, where we are as of July 1st. And what you've got is the governor is sitting on about $67 million within his campaign fund. You've got J.B. Pritzker, who is worth, you know, $3+ billion. You know, he's donated $14 million plus to his fund. And most interesting of all, he spent about $9 million in the last 3 months. That's an incredible burn rate. Now, a lot of that is hiring up, staffing up, all of those kinds of things. But that's still, I mean, there are six more quarters to get us through the 2018 election. Six times nine is 54. If you want, you know, 54 million, and so we're certainly going to, you know, the potential is, if Pritzker is the candidate, this would be hugely expensive. Now, Dan Biss, who is does not have either deep pockets or, pledges in terms of strong funders. For instance, big labor has been going, particularly the trade unions, for endorsing Pritzker. You know, Biss is sitting on about, you know, $2.3 million. He's had for normal times, a good fundraising period. But clearly, you know, he would have, you know, he's not going to have the kind of money to compete with the Pritzker in terms of the primary, unless, you know, Pritzker and the next person we need to talk about is Kennedy, and he raised very little money. And he had also a very inconsistent, couple of months out on the stump. He can be pretty impressive at some times. Other times, he can be a real disaster. And so, Biss's hope would be that Kennedy and Pritzker would, cancel each other out. The people that are funding the Democratic Party, they don't want to deal with funding a governor's race, $30, $40 million, talking big labor, big law, health facilities, and then putting up, $60 million was about what was spent on legislative races on the Rauner, Ken Griffin, that side. And the Democrats were able to match that. And so, what's really attractive in the abstract to the Democrats is either having a self-funder so that they can focus on funding the legislative races, or to have a partial state funder who's got star power. And at the moment, Kennedy hasn't demonstrated that he's got, he's got those two things yet. He might have. So it is, but it's not clear how, and it's, how the primary is going to come out, but just the amount of dollars that we're talking about are astronomical.
And just about a minute or so left. Can you talk about Rauner? I mean, we know that he has money and access to even other people's money, like a Ken Griffin, that he could, bring into a race like this. Is that showing up as well in these numbers?
Well, about 50 of that belongs, he contributed 50. He got a $20 million check from Ken Griffin. So that's our, that was $70 million that you kind of count since the first of the year. Last time around, Griffin put up about $24 million. Ulan put up about $12 million. Richard Ulan, Uline Corporation. Also, the three of them put about $10 million in Liberty Principles PAC that did a lot of independent expenditures. So, there's just an overwhelming amount of money out there. And while Governor Rauner, we have a few more disasters, he could become unelectable, but you never count him out. He's very disciplined as a candidate, and he has, for all intents and purposes, unlimited money. It is a different ballgame. This is the money in politics has changed so dramatically since 2013. It's almost difficult to describe. We had $5 million in combined spending on five different legislative races last time around. $5 million is what the three candidates for the Democratic nomination for state's attorney in Cook County spent. That's 5 million people in Cook County versus 110,000 in a legislative district. It is almost too much to comprehend in terms of how much it's changed.
And time now for our notes from the field, and Hannah Meisel.
So any Springfieldite will know the Abe Lincoln statue out front of the state fairgrounds. Apparently, its arm fell off. Young Abe, who holds the axe, his arm fell off. And so he was repaired this week, and he is right back on the fairgrounds now, just in time for the state fair, which begins August 10th, if you can believe it.
That will do it for this week on State Week. I want to thank our guests today, Hannah Meisel, Kent Redfield, and Dusty Rhodes. And you can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org. You can also find us on NPR One. Just look for State Week. Production assistance for the program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.